takes a worried man to sing a worried song. It takes a worried
Chapter 4,
man
Music. I was barely into my teens in the 1950s when I discovered a radio station blasting out of Oakland called KWBR. My favorite disc jockey was a wild man called Jumpin' George. He played this new music, well, new to me, called R&B. I was knocked out by the likes of B.B. the Blues Boy King, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, Muddy Waters, Bo Diddley. The list goes on and on. At junior high school dance parties, we'd fight over the records to play. It was me and Work With Me Annie versus the Pat Boone Love Letters in the Sand crowd. It got ugly. I sort of suspect they all became Republicans. Growing up listening to my parents' music of Glenn Miller, Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman, and Ella Fitzgerald, I loved music right from the beginning. It was only when I got a small portable record player and a radio in my room that I could explore my own music, not just what my parents listened to. It was like I was fomenting some kind of revolution, and I guess I was. Later on, when I was about 14, I remember driving one day with my father, and I had the radio on KWBR loud. He finally had enough. He reached over and hit my leg with his fist, and he yelled, "Turn off that goddamn R&B bullshit music!" Turns out, my father was expressing the outrage felt by grown-ups across the United States. After Elvis Presley appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, their greatest fears were taking shape. They hoped this new music was a passing fad. Not a prayer. In 1955, a movie was released called Blackboard Jungle. All you baby boomers may remember the movie opened with Bill Haley and the Comets playing Rock Around the Clock. It was blasting out of huge speakers on the stage. Me and all the other teenagers across the country knew at that moment there was a revolution at hand, and we were leading the charge. Everything was going to be different. But this was only the beginning. In high school, I started listening to jazz. I even saw Miles Davis at the old Black Hawk Club in San Francisco and got to interview Dave Brubeck in 1957 for my Berkeley High radio show called Berkeley Highlights. All of this was a way that I began to understand who I was, what was important to me. The music was part of my identity. And this was true for my entire generation. The music was as integral to who we were and who we became as were the twisted strands of our DNA. A psychologist friend of mine named Tom Greening loved Louis Armstrong. When Armstrong died in 1971, Tom wrote a reflection on what Louis Armstrong had meant to him. One sentence out of that reflection stuck with me. "Louis Armstrong expressed the feelings I couldn't and put me in touch with ones I didn't know I had." It was pretty much the same for me. All this new music was helping me to express the feelings that I couldn't and put me in touch with ones I didn't know I had. Along the way, there were feeble attempts to play a musical instrument. Never worked out. I didn't have the commitment to it or the discipline. In addition, since there were no musicians in my family, there were no models or no cheerleaders for me, you know, like, "Hey, I want to play the saxophone like Uncle Bob." Also, as soon as music lessons got hard, I quit. And while I never was going to be a musician, it drew me like a magnet and helped define who I was. Later in life, my PhD research was all about those early influences. My dissertation was titled Jazz, Rock and Roll, and the Revolution in Psychotherapy, 1940 to 1975. I explored all this in a recent show.
How many of you had music lessons when you were kids? Show of hands. Now, keep your hands up, please. Keep your hands up if what you remember about those music lessons brings back painful memories. That's about two-thirds. Me too, right? I had music lessons from a woman down the street called Miss Terwilliger. She had gray hair, straggly, wrinkled face. She hated kids, and I think she hated music. So I would be sitting at the piano, and I'd hit a wrong note. And Miss Terwilliger would take a ruler, boom, slap me right on the hand. "You didn't practice, did you, Ricky? No, we don't have a piano. So that was the end of piano lessons. So I gave it up for a while, and then I was in my early 20s, and I got completely taken with bluegrass. And I said, well, maybe I could learn to play the banjo, you know? So I found a banjo teacher in Berkeley. Because of my third lesson with him, he said, he put his hand on the table, he said, Rick, let's be truthful here. You don't have any talent. So I said, okay, well, So I took my banjo, I took it back. Well, so I gave up on music for a while longer, and then suddenly I was in my my late 30s, and I decided I was going to play the tenor saxophone, because I thought it'd be great for rock and roll and blues. So I found a teacher in San Rafael. Her name was Dina Pappas. She comes into the music store. First of all, she's on platform heels. She has platinum blonde hair, real tight shirt, real tight pants, red pants. She comes in and we get started. And she, now listen to this. This is extraordinary. I want everybody to really pay attention to this. You don't hear this much. Dina Pappas thought, ready? Music lessons should be fun. Jesus, what a concept, you know. Over here is Mr. Williger. Music lessons are about, you know, punishing little boys for their big mistakes, you know. It's about building your little character, little bastard, boom. Meanwhile, Dina just never criticized my mistakes. I'd be making mistakes, and she'd say, it's not about perfection, Rick. Let her rip. And she was really wonderful. And after my sixth lesson with her, she gets up to move the music stand and falls completely down on the floor. I helped her up, and she says, I'm not drunk. I have MS, and I'm going to have to stop teaching. It's just like, you know, just tore me up. And so I didn't want to get another saxophone teacher. This was the lady. So I took the saxophone back to the store. But I probably needed to give it up anyway, because I was living in a small apartment in San Rafael, and I had neighbors, you know, very close by. So I would practice in the closet. You know, a little light on, you know, because my clothes, I thought, would sort of muffle the sound. And so I'm down at the mailbox one day, and my neighbor says, hey, Rick, you're getting better. But we're really tired of Johnny Comes Marching Home. I gave up that, took the saxophone back. And then in preparing for one of the earlier versions of this show a few years ago, I decided I'd try the banjo one more time. And I found a teacher in San Francisco, a good guy. And we were on our third lesson, and he said to me, you know, Rick, you can see where this is going. He said, you know, in the music business, one of the things we've learned is music is really hard for older people. So I said, okay, well, I guess the universe is telling me I am not to be a musician. That and the fact that when things get hard, I quit. So that might be the other problem. I really gave up on music altogether, but I got to have this idea. Maybe there would be another way for me to get into music. And that would be, rather than becoming one, maybe I could hang out with them, get to know them and interview them and all that kind of stuff. So this was really fun. And I started off in 1957 at Berkeley High School interviewing Dave Brubeck. So I figured, you know, as long as I'm going to do this, I might as well start at the top, right? So Dave Brubeck came to our school. He'd been on the cover of Time magazine. And I didn't know what to say to the great man. This was backstage at the Little Theater in Berkeley. And so I said, what's the relationship between classical music and jazz? I don't remember what he said, but he did say that jazz brings people together. And I'll never forget that.
Since my interview with him in 1957, Dave Brubeck has always been huge in my pantheon of jazz gods. One story in particular endeared me to him. One time, a reporter asked Dave Brubeck, how would you like to be remembered? As someone who opened doors for others, he said. In 1960, 3 years after I'd interviewed him, his quartet was scheduled to play at a Southern white college. The students were upstairs in the gym waiting for the show to start, but the college president had a real problem with his bass player, Eugene Wright, who was black. It was such an uproar that even the governor got involved in a frantic phone call. A compromise was reached. Wright could go on if he stayed in the back of the stage. Brubeck agreed, but Dave Brubeck was only kidding. When Wright's first solo came up, Brubeck asked him to come up to the front of the stage The audience went crazy with joy over his solo. That night, right there, that college's restriction on integrated acts ended forever. Yeah, Brubeck indeed opened doors for others. My interviews over the years with musicians have been a highlight of my life. Here are some of the most memorable ones. I thought it would be appropriate to start off with Dave Brubeck's fourth child, Chris Brubeck. Most musicians I've interviewed have come from musical families. They learn music at the feet of beloved parents or relatives, usually at a very young age. But what if you were born into a musical family so famous that your father, Dave Brubeck, is on the cover of Time magazine? That is just what happened to Chris Brubeck. Growing up, Chris began to notice that there was something extraordinary about his father. He later went into rock and roll so as not to compete with Dave. Here's how he recalls what happened.
I was always interested in becoming a musician, and I didn't even realize my dad was that famous until I was, you know, like six, and I would go to a gig and say, there seem to be several thousand people walking away very happy and then hearing this music, and, you know, never mind the music, but just sort of the tribal aspect of people coming together to enjoy creativity, because that's what's great about jazz. It's actually even different every night, and people that love jazz, that's what they love about it. And then the other thing is that in terms of where my career took me, like, I don't feel like I'm the greatest bass player that ever lived or anything, or am I the greatest trombone player that ever lived, or am I the greatest composer that ever lived. But I may be one of the strongest bass-playing trombonist composers you'll ever meet. You know, it's like you go out there and you carve your identity, and bit by bit, this whole composing thing just started rolling up. I mean, you walk through the doors that the karma opens up for you. I've heard this, you know, thousands of times. People say towards the end of his career, Dave would like totter onto stage, you know, and they'd say, uh-oh, you know, maybe we waited too long to see him. He's too old, you know. Then he'd sit down and he'd start playing. The years would melt away, decades would melt away, and he'd play his ass off. He played differently, but better. He was playing with less technique and more wisdom. Dave gets on stage, and thousands of people are sending love and expectation, and Dave's going to play great. I mean, I really think there is a palpable, as yet because of our science, unmeasurable thing, but there is an actual thing that's like rejuvenation juice, you know? Nice. Yeah, and we were backstage in Germany, and this guy came back with his teenage sons, and he was thanking my dad for, he must have had some connection with the promoter to be backstage, but thanking him for how meaningful it was, and there were tears coming down his face. You know, he was so sincerely into thinking the concert was great, and he spoke English, and I asked him, I said, you know, why is this so extra meaningful? Why do we feel this extra strong reaction in German audiences? And he told me something I never thought of. He said, is because my son looks at me as I'm in the generation responsible for World War II. How could I be such a jerk to follow Hitler, to be part of a country where the society went that horrible, dark, slaughtering everyone direction? And so that there's a huge generation gap between my children, my age, in their 20s, and how they look at me as their father in this generation. So when I go to a concert like this, and I see you working with your father, it shows that there is a way that these generations can talk to each other through music. And, you know, I had no idea that that'd be meaningful, but there's history again on a big scope that I couldn't imagine as an American. And when we'd play in France, I got to know some of these rabid fans, and there was one guy named Johnny. I said, Johnny, why do you love jazz so much? And he goes, it's because jazz is the music of liberation for the French.
Taylor Eichsty. Taylor began playing piano at the age of 4. He said he took up jazz because, quote, you get to make stuff up. Here he gives advice to young players on the way up.
A lot of times I say to a lot of young students, don't do any gig for just one reason. You know, I have a rule of 2 out of 3. were good music, good people, good money. So if you do any gig for just one of those things, and it pays really well, but the music's terrible and everyone's a jerk, you're gonna leave unhappy. It doesn't matter how much it pays. Two out of three elements, you know, good people and good music, you're playing music that you feel passionate about with your good friends, you're always gonna leave that gig happy, you know? And if you commit to two out of three every time, it leads to a lot of three out of three situations, and it makes it so that you set a certain bar that you won't, you know, it makes it so that your heart's in the right place. You're playing good music with good people. That's the two out of three that ends up happening more often than not if you follow that rule. And then some gigs will pay well. But if they don't and they don't pay anything, you know, then you just make sure everyone's a nice person and it's music that you enjoy doing, you know. That's always my kind of first, most general, biggest advice.
Anton Schwartz. Anton has been a major West Coast jazz player and composer since 1996, when he dropped out of a PhD program in artificial intelligence at Stanford to pursue a career in jazz. Here he talks about the freedom and power of improvisation.
I love jazz music because of the freedom of improvisation, the freedom to not know exactly what you're going to do when you go out on the stage, and just to feel the moment and read the crowd, and you know, both in terms of what numbers you perform, how you perform them, where you take each individual one. The beauty of it for me is you know, it places you in this moment in time on this planet. Interacting with these people and these musicians, and you see what you can make of it. You know, you're at every moment you're given the choice of what to do, and there's always something beautiful and always something exciting to be done. And what's limiting you from achieving that is only your ability of mastery or lack thereof, and your willingness to see and to reach for what it is that's out there. It's very exciting and a constant challenge. When you're in that state, it's like a sharp knife. You know, it doesn't leave scars, it doesn't leave a trace. It just somehow slices through. You're completely immersed in it. It's as though none of you is taking the time to self-reflect and make memories. It's an unusual experience. It's very grounding to be able to go home at the end of the evening. You've had an experience, you've shared an experience with others. There's this at the end of the experience, there's, you know, maybe there's applause or conversation or, you know, going out for a drink afterward. You know, it's wrapped up and it's then just kind of in the ether. I think that improvisation is a bit of a way of being. I really value it in running my life. I love being surprised by things, waking up in the morning and not knowing what I'm gonna do, and seeing how the day emerges. I mean, I don't have the classic jazz lifestyle, right? I've made sure to put money away. I'm responsible in terms, you know, I try to be responsible in terms of healthcare and hygiene and all the things, you know, eat well. But when it comes to sort of day-to-day, I would not do well at all with a 9-to-5 job. I think I had one for one summer in all my life, and it was not something that I was going to repeat. After we're gone, we're just in the ether, you know, the memory of others. And I'd like to be, you know, when I'm gone, I'd like to have the same quality as maybe a great evening of music, you know, still reverberating out in the air somewhere.
Terry Garthwaite. Terry founded a band called The Joy of Cooking in the early 1970s. It was tough being a woman in an all-male-dominated field.
Circle be unbroken by and by, oh Lord. There's a better home awaiting in the sky. Yes, in the sky. The other thing that I had a hard time with, and that's still, I think, a problem in our culture, is being a woman in a man's field, which rock and roll has traditionally been. So I used to have guys who would say, oh yeah, Joy of Cooking, yeah, I heard them once, and if I shut my eyes and forgot there were women in the band, it sounded pretty good, you know. Well, thanks. And we played at Carnegie Hall, which was quite astounding for a little rock band like us to play it. Mind you, we were an unusual band because Tony Brown and I, two women, playing the lead instruments, playing, writing the songs, and doing all the vocals, and being the front people. There were no other bands like that that we knew of on the rock scene, which may have helped us get into Carnegie Hall. I'm not sure how that happened, but we were delighted to go there. And our bass player wore his tux when we did that gig. The energy in the room is always palpable. People are always dancing. We loved for people to listen as well, because we had good songs, and they did. But they could also go home and listen to the record and come to the gig and dance. And it's an exchange of energy, so the more excited they are, the more excited we are, and it's just, it's a flow, it's a constant flow. And a non-drug high, well, for us.
Joaquin Gallegos. I interviewed flamenco guitar maestro Joaquin Gallegos in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Here he describes the power of flamenco and the transcendence of working with a group.
When it comes down to it, it's all about the gut. It's a crazy quote, but Carmen Amaya, who's, they say, one of the best, not the best female dancers of all time, who died many years ago, but she had a famous quote saying, flamenco enters you through your head and goes out through your entrails. So, yeah, entra por la cabeza y sale por las entrañas. Being that, it's a root and core chakra art form. I don't think flamenco's sad, like, but there's certainly that moment of it that is. But there's also a lot of joy and power. And then there's songs that are like really, like Alegrías is joy, pure happiness. And then there's other ones that are like more that sensual kind of flirtiness. You know, it's one thing, it's great to get up by yourself, play a guitar solo, kind of feel that one man, you know, with the world, you know, the whole spotlight on you. It's like a very powerful thing. But then when you're with a group of people and you're all connecting and working seamlessly, that's an amazing feeling, which flamenco has that. Any groups have it. But there's the thing with flamenco, it's so on the edge of your pants, it's so on the edge, you know, every time. The rhythm is the glue to everything, and there's an element of improvisation. The reason we need art of any kind is to remember that soul and that core of that emotion when something grabs you. It can be any song or any emotion, but it just reminds you of your humanness, and it kind of humbles you that you do have these emotions that you need versus all this. And when I do it too, and it's stuck on your cell phone, and like a zombie, you know? And flamenco is the opposite of that. It's being so present in the moment and expressing yourself to the utmost with that gut, raw feeling.
Several years ago, I interviewed three members of the Peninsula Symphony Orchestra. Mike Bressler is an emergency room physician and plays the timpani.
What keeps you coming back year after year? It's a huge commitment of time.
Yesterday, last night, is a perfect example. I was attending at Stanford all day, and, you know, we had our usual, you know, trauma cases and dying patients and whatever. And I was exhausted, frankly. I'd been up all night the night before. I just couldn't sleep. I didn't feel very well. And then I came to rehearsal, and I frankly wasn't up for it. I really preferred not having rehearsal. But as soon as we started playing, we started rehearsing these new Chinese pieces that I'd never played before. And one of them was beautiful, and the other one was one hell of a timpani part. And wow, it was great. I just felt like just, it was like a cathartic experience. It was a perfect example of why I enjoy playing with our orchestra.
One of the cello players in the orchestra told me that it's the emotion in the room that keeps her coming back.
What in your mind keeps you coming back? What is it about the music that seems so compelling?
There are certain transcendent moments. We're working on Firebird right now. And the final chords of that just... they take you to another place. There's a shared emotion in the room. This emotion was created, in the case of Stravinsky, in 1919. And it still carries that weight. It hasn't lost anything in 100 years. There's really an emotional connection there.
Samuel Chan is a cardiac surgeon and plays violin.
Can you tell me about one of the highest or most exhilarating moments you've had in music?
Playing a big symphony like the Beethoven's Fifth, an art form to me is something to bring the human spirit to a higher level. To that degree, music achieved that level probably better than anything else, and that's why it attracts me, it draws me to it. When a good performance is done, yeah, you can feel it, you know it. It gives you a natural high, basically.
Nancy Gilliland. Nancy is a Redwood City piano player and singer. In her interview, she describes the strong emotion a song brought up for both her and the audience.
Doing a concert, and I was going to do a song from South Pacific by Rodgers and Hammerstein. And I prefaced it by talking about Rodgers and Hammerstein were signed to do this musical, and this one particular song that they planned on doing, Carefully Taught, about racism. When it was premiered to their producers, the producer wasn't going for it at all. He didn't want anything to do with the song. And Rodgers and Hart were adamant and said, Rodgers and Hammerstein were adamant and said, this is the reason why we wanted to do this musical. And if you don't want this song, we're not doing the musical. So the producer relented, the song stayed in, and the musical got the Pulitzer Prize. So I share the story, and I start to sing Carefully Taught. And it's a very short song, very powerful song. And when I finished, it was about 10 seconds before the audience responded. And you could feel the energy in the room. It was palpable. And everyone was really touched, and including me. My hands were shaking, and I saw people, you know, wiping tears away. And you know, the song was written in 1949, and it's something I think that the human race is just going to be dealing with always. And that these great guys wrote something that was so powerful, they could touch people like it's touching me now. I'm not even singing it or thinking it about it, but just the feeling that I had of doing it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Several of these musicians touched on the magic between performer and audience. This is more than just a feeling. It's backed up by brain chemistry. Recent studies using brain scan technology have shown that when music is electrifying an audience, literally the brain of the musician and the brains of the audience are synchronizing. It is more than just sound. It's biological. Nancy talked about a deep, tearful response to Carefully Taught. Terry Garthwaite and Samuel Chan talked about a non-drug high. Joaquin Gallegos talked about the transcendence of a group performance. And Chris Brubeck told the story of one fan rebuilding his relationship with his son through jazz. Music brings people together in ways we are now just beginning to understand, even at the level of biology. John Hendricks. Jazz singer John Hendricks formed a group in the late 50s called Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. For three consecutive years, they were rated as the number one jazz vocal group by Downbeat magazine. I met and interviewed John several times over the years. One of my favorite stories he told me was when he went backstage to say hi to Duke Ellington at one of Ellington's concerts. John knew Ellington and they visited a bit backstage. And then Ellington said to him, "John, look, after intermission, why don't you come out as a surprise guest to kick off the second half of the show?" John said, "Well, what should I sing?" And Ellington said, "Whatever you want." A moment later, John ran into one of the other musicians in the band named Harry Carney. "Duke wants me to start the second half of the show. What should I sing?" And Carney said, "Whatever you want." When the intermission was over, the curtain went up, and there was John Hendricks at the front of the stage with the world-class Ellington Orchestra behind him. He said he was so scared his knees were shaking. He sang "A Foggy Day in London Town," not an Ellington standard. He got two or three notes into it, and the entire orchestra was right behind him. John commented, "When you play with the greatest jazz musicians in the world, they don't need the charts. They know the music." Janis Joplin. In October of 1966, I was in Golden Gate Park fooling around with a new camera. Suddenly, I came upon Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company playing on the back of a flatbed truck. They weren't well known at the time, so the crowd was small. I elbowed my way to the front and managed to get some really great photos of her. A couple of years later, I sold three prints to Janis's family and her estate. I met with her brother Michael in a hotel in San Francisco to give him the photos. Michael's life is spent managing Janis's estate. I asked him what it was like to have been the younger brother of a girl who was so famous and then died. He was very forthcoming, and he said, "I was just a young hippie kid, sort of a misfit in Port Arthur, Texas. Suddenly, my older sister became famous. Then with her death, everybody wanted to come to our house. So I know all of the people in the rock and roll music business from Paul McCartney on down because of my sister. It's been an amazing life." Ever since I photographed her in Golden Gate Park so early in her career, I've been hugely interested in Janis Joplin's story. A few years ago, the Big Brothers road manager, John Cook, published a book called On the Road with Janis Joplin. He ends the book with one of the most passionate writings about music I've ever read. He says, "I dreamed about Janis once, in the first year after she died. She came to say goodbye and to seek, one last time, my blessing. In the dream, I'm backstage at a concert in a huge auditorium. I can see neither the stage nor the audience, but I can hear Janis at her best, singing her heart out, backed by the Full Tilt Boogie Band. When the song ends, the audience gives her a roof-raising ovation. She comes tripping down the ramp to where I'm waiting, and I see in her face the same little girl uncertainty that I'd seen so many times before. Despite the sustained applause in the auditorium, there's a real concern in her voice, and she asks me, did I do okay? I take her in my arms and hug her with all my strength. You did great. God bless and Godspeed." My connections with these musicians has always been personal. You know, my identity. If I saw Miles Davis at the Blackhawk, I'm cool. If I met Janis Joplin's brother, I'm cool. I want to conclude this chapter with three stories about music and about musicians. They may not make me cool, but they touch my heart. The first is about an unexpected happy birthday song at a Palo Alto restaurant. The second is about meeting Johnny Cash. And the third is about a senior citizen who remembered Glenn Miller. An unexpected birthday song. Years ago, our good friend Avron Barr took his then-girlfriend out to celebrate her birthday at a very nice Italian restaurant on University Avenue in Palo Alto. As the dinner progressed, his girlfriend wanted Avron to sing her happy birthday. Avron's pretty shy about singing in public. He hesitated. She kept pressing for this traditional acknowledgement. He was probably looking pretty uncomfortable. Anyway, a woman sitting next to them could not help but overhear the conversation. She politely intervened in the discussion and offered to sing Happy Birthday. This made everyone happy. Of course, Avron was off the hook. The girlfriend got acknowledged for what she wanted. The kind lady from the next door table then belted out a magnificent Happy Birthday. Her name? Joan Baez. Meeting Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins. The sexy blonde in front of me pulled down her blouse as she thrust a pen into Johnny Cash's hand with the implicit demand that he autograph her breast. He obliged. Playing off that, when it was my turn, I asked him to sign my left forearm and then turned to Carl Perkins and asked him to sign my right forearm. It was a Saturday night in 1957. My friend George Petty and I had ventured up to Vallejo, California, to a raunchy, shit-kicking, barroom brawling venue, ironically called the Dream Bowl. Johnny Cash handled that rowdy cowboy crowd with ease. He was at the beginning of a career that would do nothing less than help to shape American popular music in the last half of the 20th century. My high school friends were nuts about Elvis. Not me. My man was Johnny Cash. After I Walked the Line and Folsom Prison Blues, I was a total fan. When he died, Rolling Stone characterized Johnny Cash as biblical. The next morning in the shower, I totally forgot and washed off the autographs. No photographs. You'll just have to take my word on this one. A magic moment in Gualala, California. The Glenn Miller Orchestra was playing And the Angels Sing. I'm in the second row, sitting next to a vibrant 92-year-old lady, there with her daughter and son-in-law. I glance over and see her mouthing every word. The band director is singing the song with the velvet tones of Frank Sinatra. She is taken away to her mid-20s in 1944 when the song was popular. At the end of the song, I lean over and whisper in her ear, "You know, he was looking right at you the whole time." She blushed and says, "Oh, no." Then they played String of Pearls, and I asked her to dance. She pointed to her walker in the corner, and she said, "No, I'm afraid I can't. I might topple over." As we age, the music of our early years takes us floating on clouds of happy memories, back to those long-lost days of youth. She knew all the words to And the Angels Sing. Summary of Phase 1, Childhood. I've arbitrarily designated Phase 1, Childhood, as the years from birth to around 30. Here we've considered how we develop our personalities and our identities from our family of origin. Are we losers or are we okay? We've considered the influences of parents and even grandparents. We've even looked at what it's like to become parents. Finally, I put music in Phase 1 because, at least for me, it started as far back as I can remember and continues to today. Now in Phase 2, we turn our attention to adulthood. Fasten your seatbelt. This phase of life is more like a pinball machine than like a smooth ride up an escalator. I want to end this part of the book with a musical finale, The Ballad of Sigmund Freud. At the beginning of this chapter, I pissed and moaned about not being a musician and how hard it is for me to learn to play a musical instrument. I still contend that if I'd had a musician in my family, a cheerleader, who would have given me some support and encouragement, I could have learned to play an instrument. You know, you see these bluegrass bands, and everybody in the family plays. Little Johnny picks up a mandolin at 4 years old, and by the time he's 12, he's an expert. All because it started in the family. But that's water under the bridge. So undaunted, a few years ago, I bought a banjo and took a few lessons. For one of my recent shows, I made up a song to illustrate a point in the show. It's called The Ballad of Sigmund Freud. It tells the story of my going into therapy when I was a little kid and then finally outgrowing Freud altogether. It is sung to the tune of Worried Man Blues. with huge gratitude to Jay Lehman on electric bass. It seems like a great way to end this chapter on my love of music.
Takes a crazy kid to go see Dr. Freud. It takes a crazy kid to go see Dr. Freud. Takes a crazy kid to go see Dr. Freud. I'm okay now, no longer paranoid. Analyze my dreams to see what made me tick. Yeah! Analyze my dreams to see what made me tick. Analyze my dreams to see what made me tick. I'm okay now. Used to be a prick. Woo! Told my folks it must be due to heredity. I told my folks it must be due to heredity. It must be due to heredity. Whatever I did, you better not blame me. Woo! Finally said goodbye to good old Dr. Freud. I finally said goodbye to good old Dr. Freud. Finally said goodbye to good old Sigmund Freud. My bank account